Hello again, everybody. Welcome to an exciting, a very special co-episode of the Bullseye, Chicago Bullseye and Bulls Beat with the great one, Doug Tonis, who is back from his self-imposed exile, and in general, the fan base could not be more excited. The great one, Doug Tonis. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing great. Literally tens of people are excited for this news. Tens, at least.
There's at least 30 or 40. I'm telling you, Doug, believe me.
I'm documenting
it. No, but we are really excited because I'm excited, number one, because I feel as though over the past few years, you know, your voice does have an impact in the kind of the Bulls fandom that really matters, the knowledgeable fan base. And for whatever reason, I think all logic and reason has been lost, and you were like kind of a unique voice that did, I think, kind of bring some real weight to a lot of these issues that are, you know, with the team. And your loss has definitely hurt conversation. So it's good to have you back.
Well, it's great to be back.
Let's start out with that. And what was the reason for your exile? I know I've kind of portrayed it as you're like Luke Skywalker in The Last Jedi, and Rey came and handed you a microphone, and now you're back. But what was your reason for the people who are curious, why you kind of put a hold on the Bulls beat and for not doing the podcast with as much regularity as you once did?
Just as you know, like life comes up, and I'd gotten married, and was going back to school, still going back to school, and you know, bought a new house. Just a lot of things going on, you know, personally, and then the team was maybe at its least exciting spot possible. You're coming down from this era where even if the Derrick Rose era didn't deliver a whole lot after he tore the ACL, you know, for a few seasons, you still had hope at the beginning of the season that this time he's going to be healthy and guys will be healthy. And then all of a sudden you're like, wow, we really don't have anything. Especially last year, you knew the team was just on a complete holding pattern for a year when they signed Wade and Rondo to those short deals. You knew they were just, you know, kind of holding things off and nothing was going on. So the team wasn't really interesting. You know, you thought maybe they'll be a 40-win team, which is about what they were the last couple of years. So just not much excitement combined with a lot of busy stuff in life and you know, more exciting things to do. But this team here has actually made me a little bit excited to watch again, because even though I'm not super high on how great the potential of this group is, but it's fun. Like the guys actually seem to be playing hard, and you get to watch guys develop and progress. And it's actually now, even though they've kind of hit a rock bottom, it's on an upward trend, which is, you know, to me much more interesting to analyze. Like, there's not a lot to analyze about a team that's in a holding pattern for 2 years and not really doing anything. And so now they've kind of stripped things down, and now they're actually trying to build something back up. So there's actually a lot more to think about and talk about, and it's actually more fun to watch the team.
So let's start out with a little bit of your opinion on some of these key pieces. I'm very interested to hear what your take is on a few of these players that are going to form the core of what will hopefully be the seventh title team. So let's start out with the big one, Lauri Markkanen, who I was with you when he was drafted, and I think we were all disappointed. For those who don't know, Doug has these yearly draft parties, which bring together the most knowledgeable Bulls fans, I'd say, in the United States, all together in one place for the most part. And there wasn't a person in that room, with the possible exception, I'm trying to think, the guys from Ball, one of their brothers who was high on marketing. That was the only positive voice I heard about. I think most people were disappointed. Now, looking back, what is your take on Lauri Markkanen, and where do you think his potential is when it comes to top 25? Is he a top 25 potential? Do you think he'll max out there, or do you think you feel, like I feel he has top five talent. Do you disagree? Let's start out with your general opinion of him.
Which, you know, you really don't know with any young guy, right? But when I look at Lauri, I don't see anything that makes me think this guy has top five potential. I mean, he would need to be the next Dirk. He's not like a physically dominating player. Like, there's just nothing to, like imagine him in 5 years. Like, do you see him being better than Nikola Mirotic is in the last, like, 12 games? Or however many he's been back. Like, what about his game makes you think this guy is going to be top five? Like, he's just physically, he doesn't have that type of body. Like, athletically, he doesn't have that type of body. So you're really hoping that he becomes this amazingly elite skill player, right? Like, he's just going to be this incredible shooter, and then he can use his height to just go over guys. Like, what makes you think, like, if you compare him to Porzingis as an example, like, I don't see Porzingis as, like, a top five potential guy. And, you know, is Lowry going to be better than him, you know, when he matures? You know, it could happen. You know, anyone could develop, you know, just this incredible shot and be an incredibly skilled player. But there's no reason for me to think that. Like, his percentages now don't make me think, like, oh, my God, this is a once-in-a-generation, you know, shooting type of guy. So, mm-hmm. you know, it would be a long shot for me to see him being really even a top 20 player. I think he'd be a good player, but I don't really see him as a potential superstar. Maybe a Lil Rung all-star, you know, in the right year. You know, someone kind of like a Luol Deng-type career, obviously a very different player, but, you know, that type of career where he's really good for a long time, but not a, you know, amazing superstar type player.
Yeah, I would counter, you know, I think we always got to remember he's 20 years old. So, obviously, there's a lot of progression for this guy. No one at 20 ever was, for the most part, when you look at NBA players, they were much better at when they're 25, 26, 27. And I think...
Sure, but that's true of every 20-year-old in the league, right? You could just say that about anyone, like, hey, who's decent and young.
Yeah, but there's, you know, like, but there's not a 20-year-old that we can all think of, you know, off the top. I mean, I'm sure we could probably find one or two that are better than him right now. Right? Who's better than Ryan Martin?
Maybe at this point, but so go over the last, like, 5 years and think how many 20-year-olds had seasons that are roughly equivalent to what Lowry's doing this year. And I think there's probably quite a few. I mean, if you look at what he's doing, it's not like it's so amazing. I think his PER is, like, right around 15, which is, like, the league average. Yeah, yeah. It's not like, you know, like, Ben Simmons, as an example, strikes me as a guy with higher upside than Markkanen by a huge amount. He's also, like, a very young guy.
Yeah.
And we'll see how it goes. I mean, you know, he could develop into a great player. I'm not saying he's not. Just that, you know, it's a stretch. Like, people look at young players, and I think automatically they're going to get so much better. Most players don't get so much better. Most players make really kind of minor improvements or no improvements. Most players, you know, don't get tons better. So, you know, you have to hope for that. Some of them obviously do. You know, everyone kind of goes through a stage. Very few guys just, you know, LeBron the league and set it on fire from day one. Most guys, you know, have a pretty big leap, you know, at some point in their career. And Markkanen looks like a guy who definitely is going to be very good, but I don't see where you think top five, except just hope.
Yeah, well, I would say, to me, it's that he's going to shoot the ball better. He's not shooting it great, and that's supposed to be his number one strength, right? He's 33. I think he's right around 33% from three. Might he actually be lower than that right now? Haven't looked at the latest numbers, and I think he's got the potential to shoot it much better. When you can do that, and you could post up like he can, which I think he's shown that ability. You know, I'm hoping he does have top five talent. So you differ with me on this. Obviously, you think he's still a good player, no doubt. I think you agree, but you're definitely tempering expectations with him. Let's move on to Chris Dunn. Chris Dunn, I feel, has top 15 potential. Incredible athlete. You know, a big question about him, can he shoot it? And he's shown to me dramatic improvement in that area. Still not where it needs to be. Where do you feel about Chris Dunn's ceiling is?
I could repeat much of the same things I said about Markkanen. You know, I don't think you can make grand assumptions about how much better he's going to get. You know, there's a chance that he's not going to be a whole lot better. But I like Chris Dunn. You know, it reminds me, I think I said this on my last podcast or I just posted in Real GM, but watching him play reminds me a lot of the first time I saw Russell Westbrook play. And it was at the Orlando Summer League. And I was watching Westbrook, and he was just like a terror on both ends of the court. But he was completely out of control at the same time. And I watched Chris Dunn, and it's like he's the same way. He's sliding back and forth. Like, he's always playing at full speed. You know, he rebounds really tough. He just seems like always on both ends. But then his dribble gets, like, really loose at times. His shot still needs, you know, a lot of work. And if you actually look at Russell Westbrook's numbers from his rookie year, they actually look very, very similar to what Chris Dunn's numbers look like right now. Like the same, like, poor three-point shooting, same low overall field goal percentage, but you saw, like, high rebounds, high assist numbers, and Westbrook developed into, like, a very good, you know, scorer, obviously. You know, he turned into a great scorer. And I don't know that I'm going to say Chris Dunn is going to do the same thing, but watching him, like, I see a lot of those same types of features. So you really have to hope that he figures out a way to become consistent scoring. And if he does, then he can become, you know, a top 15 player. I agree. But I would say, I would caution that that's also not likely to happen. You know, it's more rare that guys make those types of big leaps. But, you know, Dunn to me has higher potential than Markkanen. His NBA body, I think, is better. Just his style of play just unleashes terror on both ends of the court. You know, I don't see Markkanen becoming a, you know, defensive stopper. I don't see him like unleashing terror everywhere. You're really going to hope he plays like Dirk Nowitzki. If everything turns out perfectly, like that's what you're kind of hoping for. And, you know, Dirk is, maybe he was a top five player, you know, for some part of his years. Maybe, I don't know. He's maybe a guy on the edge, but we'll see. I actually am a little higher on Chris Dunn's potential, but I think he also has, you know, much lower floor too. There's a better chance that Chris Dunn is not going to live up to that because the improvements he needs to make, I think, are more difficult. I agree with you. Markkanen's just going to start shooting better, you know, with more time and practice in the league. And his skill set is pretty high, and his floor is actually very high. So I do think that Dunn may be less chance of reaching that potential, but I actually think his potential is a little higher.
That's a great overview. And I mean, anybody hears excitement, any comparison, the Russell Westbrook, I mean, you got to be ecstatic. I kind of view it, I said this yesterday, I saw a lot of John Wall. You know, John Wall, I think, is a very similar player to Dunn. Obviously, he's not as good as John Wall yet, but you see the characteristics, the elite athleticism, the length, the ability to really make a difference on the defensive end. And that's it. You're right. That's what separates Markkanen from Dunn. I'm not as high on Dunn as I am with Markkanen just because I think the shooting ability will create so many more opportunities for Markkanen, and I think that's going to hurt Dunn. I just don't see him becoming the shooter. But when you think about it, Westbrook and Wall really aren't great shooters either, right? And they're still able to be all-star level, all-star caliber, really game changers. So it sounds like...
And Rajon Rondo is another guy, I think, in the same mix. A guy, like, very lanky, you know, athletic, not a good shooter, but good ball handler, can still do a whole lot for you on offense without being a great shooter. So there are guys that you can mix in like that, but you do have to surround those guys with the right types of players. Mm-hmm. Presently, the Bulls actually look like they're doing that. Like, this is actually the first team in forever that it's just like stock full of shooters. You know, it's been so long since I can't even. It's watching the Bulls this year is crazy to me. Like, everyone can shoot threes. Like, we've never had that in the past 5 years.
Right. That's a great point. Zach LaVine, I'd like to, obviously he's not back yet, but what was your opinion on him as a player before he was hurt? And, you know, I'd like your opinion on how you think he's going to come back to his team. I think you were the only guy I spoke with. I think you mentioned this in a conversation before where you could actually see the Bulls getting worse when he comes back for a certain period of time.
For sure.
Elaborate.
And I think LaVine is interesting in that so many Bulls fans have strong opinions on him. And I can be honest, like, how many Timberwolves games have I watched where Zach LaVine played like a whole lot of minutes? It's not many, like maybe like 4, 5. I mean, it's not like I think any Bulls fan who has a strong opinion probably really has seen a whole lot of Zach LaVine. We obviously haven't seen him in a Bulls uniform. So most of my thoughts on Zach LaVine are just like looking at his statistical profile. And LaVine is almost like the anti-Chris Dunn. You know, Chris Dunn can kind of just plays like a terror on both ends. But you look at LaVine's statistical profile, he's a guy who doesn't rebound. He's a guy who doesn't really get any assists. But he is a guy who scores really well with very good efficiency, can shoot the ball well. We know he's athletic, but it doesn't look like from his statistical profile that he really uses that athleticism to his advantage. He's not generating lots of free throws. He's not generating, you know, tons of looks at the basket. So, you know, I'll be interested to see how he fits in with the team. I do think anything that gets you out of playing Paul Zitzer minutes probably improves the team. But Zach LaVine, I think you're going to see a little bit of what I'll call the Derrick Rose recovering from ACL effect. And that's that he's going to come in, he's probably going to try and, you know, find his rhythm. He's going to think he's an elite scorer right away. He's still going to struggle doing some of the things he used to be able to do. He's probably going to fire up too many shots early and have poor efficiency until he finds his rhythm. It's going to take him some time to get his NBA wind up. Like, all this stuff is not easy. And you saw with Rose, like, I don't know if he really ever recovered until he left Chicago. And he kind of did a little better with the Knicks where he kind of fell back into, okay, I can be a role player a little bit and wasn't just trying to do everything at poor efficiency. And so we'll have to see how that goes with Lizdeen. But I think initially, you know, you have a team that's gelling pretty well right now and playing pretty well. Bring in another guy who's going to want a lot of shots and is going to change up the way the team looks offensively and is going to play a lot of minutes potentially. I think that is, you know, maybe going to have a little bit of an impact negatively, even though he's a much better player than the guys he's replacing. It's just going to change, you know, the way the team is constructed and works together and plays together for a little bit.
I know this is a little bit of a difficult question because we don't know what Levine's going to look like. But let's just assume he approaches or slightly surpasses what he was in his last year with Minnesota. And Dunn makes a progression that you expect, and Markkanen, you know, kind of tops out of what you said before, like a dang level all-star. Obviously not the same player, but, you know, just a general review of the career. Are those three guys, assuming that the Bulls make some smart choices in role players around those three, is that core of those three enough, in your opinion, to win a title in the next 5 years?
So if everyone tops out, which is extraordinarily unlikely, but if everyone tops out, then maybe. I'd still say you're pretty close. And we were discussing this because we're playing Washington a little bit on Twitter, and you mentioned, you know, Porter, Beal, and Wall. And so I look at those three guys, and I think the way they're playing, you would think that those three guys would be, if they top out, would be at least as good as the Bulls three you just named. And I think really it would depend on what you get out of Chris Dunn. And like I said, I think it's pretty unlikely he reaches his ceiling. But if he really can become, you know, a John Wall type or Rajon Rondo or Russell Westbrook, but like really be a guy who can command an offense and can take that step to becoming an all-star level, you know, and Markkanen can become a low all-star level guy, you know, you'd have a chance. But I think you would still need then a team of tremendous depth, and you'd probably have to hope for like a couple lucky seasons where people are playing a little bit above their level. It's not really a team that's right there. And I think this is why the people who would like to tank are of that opinion. You know, like it's probably not enough. And it's unlikely that all these guys are going to top up to get you close. They're most likely you're going to have guys that fall short of that. So, yeah, I think that is why people still feel this team probably needs to add another young piece and talent. I guess the other thing is you don't know the Bulls have a ton of cap room that they can use this offseason. I don't really think there's something great you could pursue that you could get. And I don't know if you'd be like excited if you added like DeMarcus Cousins. I personally don't like DeMarcus Cousins and think he's not someone who's going to help you win games. But if you could get him or, say, Paul George, I also kind of feel similarly about Paul George. I don't think he's that great. So I don't think there's, like, a lot of great options. And even the ones out there, I don't think would come here. But if you could add another, like, all-star caliber player and those guys also topped out in free agency, you know, then I think maybe you'd have something. But I don't see it. I don't see this team as it's being constructed right now. Unless they get a generational talent somehow, I don't see them really having a realistic chance at a title.
I think the Bulls' plan was to tank, obviously, this year and get that one more, you know, great, hopefully franchise transformational player, which apparently there are several of them in this upcoming draft, and then kind of use all that cap space to kind of like how they did in 2010, add a lot of nice little, you know, Kyle Korver-type pieces for reasonable dollar amounts to fill out the rest of the cap space. And now this winning streak is kind of screwed, obviously almost screwed that up. I guess predictions from you, I'd love to hear. You think, knowing John and Gar probably better than any of us, you think they're going to make those trades, or you think they might stick with the team and that's been very competitive and say, you know, we're going to add Levine. Let's see where this group goes and go with, you know, kind of like the plan that I was describing that we just discussed, right? Just building around this core and then trying to find the right combination around them.
Yeah, it's interesting because you got to start thinking about how are you going to keep all these guys in a few years. You know, Levine, you're going to have to make an expensive decision on immediately. And then you're going to have to pay up to Bobby Portis. If he continues to play at the level he's at, he's going to command over $20 million a year. Nikola Mirotic's next deal is going to be a max deal if he's playing like this. And I don't know that either of those guys are going to continue that for a whole season or how things will go. But you really got to start thinking that Levine is going to be over $20 million. And then Chris Dunn, in a couple more years, you're going to have to pay up. So this team isn't ready to win a title now, but like all the pieces that you're talking about are going to be due for huge raises. So the Bulls are really going to have to choose who they want to keep and who they don't want to keep. And so if I'm making that decision right now, what I would think is I probably don't want to pay Mirotić a max contract. Mm-hmm. And whether you trust him to continue playing well or not is up for debate. You know, I think the way he's playing now still surprises me because it's such an outlier versus his past three seasons. And so I still tend to look at like the total quality of games he's played over the rest of his career and think, I don't suspect that he'll sustain this rate. But I don't think they want to pay him the max. I probably wouldn't want to pay him the max. And so I would then trade him as soon as I could. Because now, if he's not going to be part of the future, I don't really want him getting me wins right now. You know, I'd rather get back into draft position. And if you look at where the teams are, judging, you know, a tank tracker, you're basically judging wins. You want as few wins as possible. So the Bulls right now are 13 wins. Atlanta is in the number one spot with 10 wins. And there's, I think, one other team. I think it's Orlando has 12. Maybe there's a few other teams with 12. But you're like right there where if you could aggressively go back to being bad, which would not be very hard, you could easily be in the top three teams for a draft pick going into this draft. So I think if you look at Mirotić and you say, I'm not going to keep him, then don't have him here getting you a bunch of wins right now. And also sucking up minutes from Portis and from Lowry, who are guys that you want to develop if you view that you're going to keep them. So I think they'll probably make the trade. I mean, unless they view Mirotić as a long-term piece, I don't see where it makes sense to keep him.
And it sounds like you would agree with that decision to move Nico. If I appointed you as GM, you would move him.
I would try to, yeah. I definitely would. And I think if he continues to play like this through February, one, it might be too late to move him and get back in the draft position. But two, you would think you'd be able to get a pretty good return. I mean, he's on a really, really cheap deal relative to his current ability. And right now, Nico looks like a guy who would help a team trying to win a title a whole heck of a lot.
Absolutely, especially with coming off the bench role. I mean, so many contenders have nothing off the bench, and Washington being one of them. This question I'm glad you're on for, because you're one of the few people I think I know, maybe the only person I know, who actually kind of agrees with me at some level that Gar and Pax are competent. You know, Gar-Pax are routinely destroyed in this town for being completely incompetent, not knowing what they're doing. Can you provide a few examples or instances where that counter this narrative?
I think the examples are too many to count, to be honest. Fans frequently have just a ridiculous set of expectations for what they expect their general managers to do. You look at John Paxson's history. He took over a team that was just a train wreck and was in cap hell and rebuilt it into a playoff team in like 1 year when he first started here. And then when that team like flamed out, he rebuilt that team in 1 year. And now we're already talking about the Bulls being too good too soon this year, because when he ripped down this team, it looks like they might be in place to rebuild this team in 1 year with young players. And no bad contracts. So, I mean, it's really, like, try and find any other GM that's done that. Like, if you do, you'll be, like, naming, like, the super elite general managers of the NBA. I mean, and I get people think, like, oh, we haven't done this, we haven't done that. The Bulls had a team that could have easily won a title if people stayed healthy.
Yeah.
You know, people complain they didn't put enough pieces around them or they didn't get whatever. No, what happened is Derrick Rose got hurt. This team, you don't think that if they had been able to stay healthy, that this team would not have had a very good chance at a title in the Derrick Rose era? When Joakim Noah was getting MVP votes, and you had Jimmy Butler, who becomes a superstar, you had Nikola Mirotić, who became the player he is right now, you don't think this is a team that could have had a chance to win? I mean, and people, like, rip them for their drafts? Like, it's crazy. The Bulls are maybe the best drafting organization in the NBA. Like, I dare you to find, like, which team is better. So it's like, maybe one or two teams that are in the conversation. Like, you look at their picks, and it's like, outside of Doug McDermott, which was a train wreck on the way in and on the way out, like, everything they've done in the draft has pretty much been gold. Yeah, Mirotić, you know, obviously Butler, obviously Gibson, all of their top picks. When you look at this draft, Lowry looks good. Given a couple of years, Bobby Portis looks like you know, a steal where he was taken.
Yes, 22.
You know, I mean, and Valentin is not looking much better. Mm-hmm. So this is a general manager group that actually has done a very good job. They do work under constraints of like a small market team. This is not a team that wants to spend a lot of money. They do have to make a lot of financial decisions that people often hate, and I understand why. But they're always looking, you know, towards the future. I don't know. I think this is actually, I think they're very good. Like, there's just not a lot of times you look at what they've done and you say, wow, that was stupid based on, you know, what their objectives were. And their objectives probably aren't always to win a title at all costs, which is what we would like as a fan. But that's not what ownership is saying. You know, ownership is really, you know, they put pretty tight financial constraints on these guys. That's why when people hate, like, the Kyle Korver trade, when they moved him away and said that was a bad decision, it was a 100% financial decision, and it was made because they knew Derrick Rose wasn't going to be around the next year, and they weren't going to compete that year. You know, like, decisions like that are made for reasons that aren't purely basketball. And I don't know. I think they're actually pretty good. Yeah, they might not be in the upper echelon of GMs, but they definitely are in the upper echelon of drafters in scouting. And I think most of their trades work out pretty well. You know, they hit the objectives they want. They're able to save money. They're able to bring in more talent. They don't get screwed on trades very frequently. So I think overall their history is very strong.
And I think to counter it, right, here's some of the arguments you'll hear. And I'd like to get your opinion on some of these specifically. So one I always hear is drafting Teague at 29 in that draft when Draymond Green was right there in the second round. What's your take on your counter to that?
As you know, and we've talked about this lots of times, so you're just setting this up to rehash conversations we've had. Golden State passed on Draymond Green like a pick right before they took him.
Twice. They had
for
two
some
first
dude who's out of the league.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone else passed on Draymond Green for like, what, 32, whatever many picks were ahead of him. I forget it. He was in the low 30s. And so they're both. Teague was a guy that didn't think was going to be there. And he had elite NBA athleticism, a great handle, and he had some big weaknesses in his game. But T could have easily been a great player. Like, he had the package of stuff that could make a great player. He didn't work. He didn't do whatever. He didn't improve. You know, and that's why I say it's dangerous to project out that guys will improve. Teague is actually one of my favorite weird unicorns, and that he's the only player I've ever seen that I can think of that could just ridiculously easily blow past his defender and get in the paint, but then still sucked. Like, everyone else who has that skill is like a great player. You know, like, if you could just get in the paint, then you can finish or you can pass or you can, you know, do something. Like, if you can get into the paint, you're like almost always really good. And Teague could do that. Like, it will, but then he could do nothing else. And I know of no other player that had that skill, but it didn't end up also being, you know, pretty good, at least serviceable. So I get why they drafted Teague. I think he actually had, I think it was a good pick from a what could this guy become type of methodology. You know, it was a guy, you took a flyer on someone who showed a lot of statistical weakness in college, and there are reasons to think, like, yeah, this guy might not be so good. But that's why he was there at 29. You know, guys who are sure things aren't there at 29.
Right, exactly. And we do have to touch on this one, because this is the biggest one that the hammer likes to be laid down, is Doug McDermott at 11. And I would counter, first of all, in that draft wasn't a very good draft. It was just a year where there's no All-Stars in that draft. I looked at a cursory look. I think Joel Embiid will be the first one this year if he makes the team. And that's still an if. He hasn't played enough. He'll probably make it. But Joel Embiid will be the first All-Star out of that draft class. And people act like they traded him, you know, for, it was Gary Harris. It's not Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, you know. They're good players, but they're not. Doug McDermott's still a rotational player, right? He's not a bust. He's not a guy like an Anthony Bennett who's out of the league in a few years, picked one overall, right? Let's get your justification for that one. I know you try to justify it because I know you weren't behind that decision.
I wouldn't justify it. It was a terrible mistake.
Okay.
That's it. That's the justification. Like, I mean, and you don't know, like, the guys that was at Nurkic and Harris that were taken by Denver. You don't know if the Bulls were going to take the same guys, right? Like, they could have taken two other guys that were better or worse or whatever, and it may not have been a great draft class, and it may be that Denver took possibly the two best guys that they could have gotten with those picks, I think probably for sure, and you wish we had those guys. And I hated the trade the day it was made. I hate it today. I hate the trade we made getting rid of him too, which was equally bad. But that's the thing about being a GM. Like, not all of your moves pan out. You don't have to say, like, oh, wow, he screwed up in this one time, so now everything is terrible. You know, I mean, you can go find moves that the Spurs screwed up. Is anyone going to say that their organization is terrible? Doug McDermott was, I think, probably the worst decision that the Bulls made. There were obvious reasons why it might not be a good decision when they made it, and it didn't turn out well. So, oh, well, you know, they screwed up. But you look at their draft history overall, and it's, like, just incredible. It is, like, absolutely incredible. So if you're going to rail against these guys, the draft is the wrong place to do it. Even if you want to say they screwed up the McDermott thing, yeah, they did. So what? You know, look, go get the draft history of any other team in the league and see who's done better. I mean, if you really study it analytically, there's just no evidence for that. So they missed on this one. They took a flyer on a guy that they really liked, you know, who brought a need that the Bulls really needed at the time, but it didn't work out.
What about the decision, and this is where I think where all the anger is based, is firing Tom Thibodeau and then obviously hiring Fred Hoiberg. Does the recent success change your opinion of Fred Hoiberg and also the decision to fire Tom Thibodeau?
I don't think I had no problem with them getting rid of Thibodeau. You know, a lot of the things we were complaining about him doing when he was with the Bulls, he's still doing with the Timberwolves.
Yes.
And, you know, I think it was you mentioned Jimmy Butler is complaining about playing too many minutes, you know, under Thibodeau in Minnesota. You know, he's still, like, wearing guys into the ground by playing them too much. He didn't get anything out of Chris Dunn, who we now see as a guy who's really helpful. So, yeah, there's no problem getting rid of Thibodeau. And I think Thibodeau is still a good coach. You know, I think he brings some strength. But he was here for a while. I think his time had come. You know, there was a lot of unrest between the players and the coaching staff and management. And you needed to start jettisoning, like, these pieces. Is Fred Hoiberg the right hire? Certainly, you know, the way the team has played now that they've gotten rid of, we'll say, these, like, veteran presences who were kind of entitled and maybe had their own negative vibe because they were going from a title team to a rebuilding team. And I think that's really hard. You know, if you think about your life and you work for a company and you're at some, like, massive growth phase and you're making huge money and you're getting big bonuses and work is awesome and everyone's having a great time, and then all of a sudden you go through, like, a rough 3 years, and, you know, bonuses are lousy, and, you know, the attitude of the company is not so great, and you're wondering whether you're going to stay in business. Like, your job is not so fun. You probably don't like your management as much, even if it didn't change. So, like, some of those things, I think once you got rid of these guys, you had this, like, negative vibe about the team, and you replaced them with young guys who are just out there trying to prove themselves and, you know, really trying to find their way in the NBA, and you're getting the culture back. Now, all of a sudden, Fred does look like a better style coach. And also, these guys fit what he wants to do, right? He's a guy who wants to have this kind of more up-tempo, lots of shooting type of offense, and he now has guys who can do that. You know, the teams he had before, when they're not doing so great, he didn't really have that. And so I think Fred's probably fine as a coach. I don't know that I think he's a great coach, but I don't think he's a terrible coach either. He's also a guy who's just finding his way in the NBA a little bit, you know, his first gig in the NBA. So I think, you know, he's okay. I think the Bulls in general have done, you know, pretty well with coaches. The only thing I would say with the Hoiberg hire that was surprising is how much money they gave him and how many years they gave him for a guy, you know, who's really has no NBA coaching experience. And it's not like he was winning tons of titles in college or anything. Yeah, that seemed like they maybe paid him more than they needed to, but it's not my money and it doesn't count against the cap. So, you know, what do I really care?
Exactly. Who cares? Right. It's between them and ownership. And I think going back to Tibbs, to me, the issue with Tibbs is, and I kind of realize this, is it all comes down to his singular focus to win one game. That's all he cares about is winning one game, the game in front of him, the regular season game. And you just got to look at the bigger picture sometimes in an NBA season. You know, that's the reason he didn't play Dunn. That's the reason he doesn't play rookies, is because rookies by nature are going to make a ton of mistakes that are going to cause you to potentially lose games. And he's going to play starters into the ground because they're going to help you win those games. But in the big picture, you wear down your starters and your rookies don't get any better. And they don't get the experience they need, you know, to progress. And he just cares about winning that one game. And, you know, I'm glad he's gone because I think the big problem with the Bulls, and no one wants to admit this, is Rose and Noah deteriorated at a rate far earlier or far greater than they should have. Those guys should not be walking around right now a shell of themselves at the ages they are. You know, they're both, Rose is under 30. No, I think it's 30, might be 31, and he can't even play anymore. I mean, come on. You know, you think it's just coincidence? It's like, and look at how Deng looks today. And, you know, look how I think Jimmy's going to look in a couple of years, you know. So, it's an argument that will go on for ages, I'm sure, until this group is out. But I don't know if you felt the same way. Thibodeau, big time. I mean, well, you said so, right? You're glad he's gone.
Yeah,
Really.
I think it was time for him to leave. I think he was a good coach for where the Bulls were when he came in. I think he did a good job while he was here. I mean, they were at it. They were a team that needed to win games and try and win a title. I do think if he had changed a few things about his approach, they would have. I do agree. He probably wasn't quite big picture enough and was too focused on the singular game. But there was a few years where I think that really did, breed a mentality that the Bulls needed to be successful.
Yes.
And got them very close. So I think he was a good coach when he was here. I have no complaints about his tenure here, but I also think it was time to move on from him when the book was done.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you a question about big picture now for this team, in the league in general. I mean, how many more years do you feel LeBron has? This is insane that this guy is still playing at this level, at this age, and without any let up. I mean, how many more years is this going to go on? Would you predict? And what do you, go ahead.
I would say, one, probably the steroids are better now than when, Michael Jordan played. So he could do better.
How dare you? This is going to be front page news on a trip tomorrow. Tony Sakusa's James is steroid use.
I actually think pretty much every elite athlete is taking some kind of performance enhancing drug. I think Jordan definitely was. You look at the way he bulked up, and you look at Jordan's mentality of like, I think he would kill his sister to win a game. If someone told him there was a pill he could take that would make him better, there's no way he wasn't taking it. But that's either a different argument, and it's a little bit in jest. You never know, and I don't even like talking about the concept of it because I just feel it cheapens the entertainment. Like I don't actually mind that people are trying different things in some ways. But I think LeBron. He's probably got another 3 years, I'd say, and it depends. We should start to see some type of decline from him, but he is just such a physical beast, and I think we have seen at times him get worn down and have some decline. It will depend like what kind of players are around him. I think having Kyrie really helped save him, for those years when they were in Cleveland because Kyrie could do a lot of the ball handling and could really kind of save up some of his energy. And allow LeBron to just take over when he needs to. And, it'll be interesting to see how that works when Kyrie is gone for several years and LeBron has to do more and more, unless Isaiah Thomas becomes this, great player that can, or I shouldn't say becomes, but comes back at the level he was with Boston, which seems a little difficult for me to believe only because I thought, I wasn't really high on him staying at that level even in Boston. He kind of seemed a little fluky to me. A guy who just got away with tons of illegal dribbles and carries and, but
Right.
I guess it's a different thing. But it will depend. If Isaiah Thomas plays really well and can help ease some of the ball handling burden off LeBron, then I think that would extend his career some as well. I think LeBron's probably still got at least 3 years of like greatness, and probably even a few more after that of just great. I mean, if you look at like Kobe, I mean, I don't know how old he was when he finally retired, but he was still, pretty darn great up until the Achilles. So I think LeBron will play a long time. And when we were watching Jordan play, Jordan probably could have played at a very high level up until like 39, 40 if he had, stuck with it and had not retired, the second time. So I think LeBron's got at least till 36
Do you think he's
at
gonna?
playing at this top league type level.
So, which begs the next question, betting man today, do you think he'll be with Cleveland next year, or is he going out west?
It's hard to imagine what he could do. It really is. The thing is, what LeBron will do is I think he'll look and he'll say, what is the best situation for me? And I think there's a difference in mentality with players now. They're more empowered, I think, to think of themselves and not the team or the fan base or the whatever. They don't have the same type of loyalty they had in the past. And I know that kind of sounds like a negative, but I actually think it's a big positive. I think the players should be looking out for themselves. The teams certainly don't look out for them as soon as they're too old or too whatever, you know, so they should be looking for the best situation and the best scenario for themselves. You know, it's why they have free agency. It's why they fought for this right to exercise it. So I think that's actually a great thing. And I think LeBron actually choosing Miami, even though I hated it at the time, and then going back to Cleveland, which was a much better story, you know, I think he's really helped pave the way for people to feel completely free to just be as mercenary as possible. I know people were doing that before, but it's like now it's not even like a stigma, you know, as it was, you know, certain times. I think now you don't even see as much rage as you do. Like the home team losing a star maybe has some, but the rest of the NBA doesn't like get that same type of rage that they might otherwise. And so LeBron will analyze what is the best situation for me, and then he's going to choose that. And it's hard for me to see which situation is going to be better for him than Cleveland. You know, I don't think LA is going to be better, even though people are talking about that. You know, everyone's talking about how, you know, LA is this and that and has great possibilities. There's, I don't see why anyone's excited about what LA is doing. I don't see why Lonzo Ball is like a news story. You know, like, it's like this guy's not so great. You know, it's like it just, we'll see how things go. But I think his best bet is probably to stay in Cleveland, but we'll have to see where things line up for them.
You know, I got to disagree. I think LA is going to look, I mean, if you step back and look at the Cleveland Cavs without LeBron, where you got Kevin Love and a bunch of pretty decent role players, Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball in year two and three are going to look a lot better. The weather's going to look a lot better. And most importantly, LeBron's done a great job of setting up Dan Gilbert as the bad guy here. Because if he leaves and he goes to L.A., Cleveland's not going to blame LeBron anymore. He's already won him a title. He's promised what he said he would do. He's delivered on what he said he would do. And he's made Dan Gilbert look like the bad guy in this whole situation. And I think it's brilliant. And I hope he does leave for that reason. Also selfishly, because if he goes to L.A., are you scared of Boston? Is Boston, where do you think Boston is going to go? I mean, let's start with that question. Do you feel Boston's going to beat the Cleveland this year, number one? And number two, where do you feel they're going to end up in the next 4 or 5 years?
So, one, no, I don't think they can beat Cleveland this year. And, you know, two, maybe they're the best team left in the East if LeBron leaves. But I agree with you. They're not so scary. It just means the West is going to continue to dominate the East.
Right.
The Western Conference Finals will be your real NBA Finals. But for the same reason, I think, like, why would LeBron want to go West? You think LeBron's going to look at Lonzo Ball and Ingram, and he's going to go, yeah, me and these two guys, we can take out Steph Curry and Kevin Durant and Draymond Green and Klay Thompson? Like, right. You think he wants to fight that with them? Like, no. No, I don't. I mean, and maybe those guys are going to become good players at some point. I'm not actually convinced that necessarily that they will, but maybe they will, and that's fine. But he could just as well go to the Bulls. The Bulls have as good a situation, and maybe even better than L.A. And he get to stay in. I don't think there's any chance he's coming here not to try and get anyone hopes up. But we probably have a better core than L.A. does. I don't get the infatuation with Lonzo Ball at all. You know, I get like he can pass and he can dribble and he's big and tall, but like this dude cannot score. He's shooting like 30% from the field. He's just not a threat. He's like Ricky Rubio.
No.
I mean, it's not a guy who's going to, it's not a guy who's going to get you like all these wins. So, like all the hype machine built around this guy. It's like one of the most confusing things I've ever seen. It's probably because his dad is so brilliant at marketing the heck out of everything. But, you know, it's just, I don't see LA as being a very exciting destination. And if I'm LeBron, I sure as heck don't want to go to the West. LeBron's probably bounced in the first round of the playoffs in the West.
What happens if he joined Houston?
Too many good teams in the West.
What about Houston Rockets joining his buddy Chris Paul and Harden forming a trio there? I think Houston's got a shot of winning in the West this year.
I don't know how they get the cap room to pull that off. I've not analyzed that situation.
Yeah.
If Houston somehow can free up space for LeBron and still keep Harden and Paul, I think that's a pretty appealing situation.
Yeah. That's the one team I think that's a little bit of a wild card. Everybody's been focusing on L.A. I just hope it happens, right? I just want them out of the East for once. Goodness gracious.
It'd be nice not to have to go through LeBron.
Wouldn't it?
Really nice.
Until the finals, at least. You know what I mean? How about Golden
State? Like I said, if you're LeBron, why are you going out West? Seriously, why would you do that to yourself?
Yeah.
It's much more difficult. The teams aren't going to be radically better. Like I said, you would be better off joining the Bulls than the Lakers.
And so it sounds like you're a little bit down, and I feel this way too. I agree completely. I mean, everyone is waxing poetic about the Boston Celtics, and I look at their situation, and they're going to owe, their salary cap situation, assuming that they sign, you know, Irving was a year and a half, I think he signed out for. They're going to owe like $30 million to Horford in 2020. You think Al Horford's going to look great in 2020? You know, how long is he going to keep on playing at this level? He's already on the other side of 30. And, you know, who knows with the injury, with the major injury that happened earlier this year, what is that team going to look like? You know, I don't think that situation is like a guaranteed home run that everyone seems to think it is with Hayward's injury. And they already owe him 35, right?
I don't think anyone, I don't know, maybe we're talking to different people. I don't think anyone looks at Boston like, oh, this team is just set up to be a super elite team.
They are a team that has
serious question marks. They're a team that has a lot of talent. They're a team that could be extremely good. But they're a team with a ton of question marks. And with Gordon Hayward's injury, he might never come back and play at a great level. You don't even know how those guys are going to fit. I thought Hayward was one of those pretty heavily overrated guys to begin with. Horford, I agree, you know, clearly likely to slow down. I mean, it's not that that's such a big deal if you only have him signed out to 2020. And really, at this point, no contracts are super long-term, right? The most you have guys for is like 4 years, so it's not, you know, super big deal like it used to be when you had those seven-year-long deals and you could just get hosed for, you know, more than half a decade. But I don't think Boston is anything that's, you know, a lock. You know, they could be really good, but they will have salary cap problems. They will have flexibility problems. And, you know, like we noted earlier when discussing the Bulls, say the Bulls lock up Dunn and Markkanen and Levine and Mirotic and Portis, we'd be in the same boat, right? Like, we also would have huge cap problems, you know, as time goes on. You know, that's part of managing the way you run your team. And it's difficult. It's difficult to, you know, get all this talent and then once everyone plays well, figure out who you need to pay and who you need to let go, you know, who's worth it, who's not. And if you don't have true superstars, if you don't have a LeBron or a Kevin Durant or Anthony Davis or whoever, you know, those decisions are really hard. It's really tough because, you know, is someone like Hayward, is he worth what you paid him?
Yes. You
know, I would think the answer is probably not, but, you know, it's like, what are your alternatives? Like, your alternatives aren't very good. So it's a difficult situation, and Boston, I don't think, has a true superstar. Maybe Kyrie Irving is that guy, maybe, but they're definitely going to be a dicey team.
Yeah, I mean, Hayward's got a player option, just to point this out, of $34 million in 2021. So, to me, everything depends on how he kind of responds to this catastrophic injury. If it's like Derrick Rose and he doesn't come back to what he was, it's going to be a horrible drag on the Boston Celtics going forward.
Yeah, it's game over, just like it was for us.
Exactly.
I mean, it really is the end of them being an elite team, right? You really need him to come back and play at a high level for them to be an elite team.
No, agreed completely. How about the Golden State Warriors? Let's go back to them for a little bit. I mean, do you feel like they're going to just dominate and win another title this year and probably in the foreseeable future with the way they're structured? Or do you feel like legitimately, like I do, that the Rockets pose a serious threat this year?
I think it's hard for me to see someone being the Warriors. You know, certainly the Rockets pose a threat. You know, they're playing very well. But it's hard for me to see someone, you know, being the Warriors. You do have always the thought that injuries can happen. You know, Steph Curry has had injury problems at various points in his career, none that have been serious, and he's not been able to come back from. But he's had injury concerns at different points. You know, the other thing that could maybe hurt them is if their ownership just refuses to pay at some point and they have to start jettisoning players because they really have so many expensive deals. A few things really worked out with them well financially with, like, Curry's extension in the past, but at some point you're going to have to pay up everyone, and you're either going to have to swallow, like, a $50 million luxury tax, or you're going to have to start letting some of these guys go. And then maybe apathy hurts them after a while, you know, but I think the fact that they lost that one title stops that. It's not like they've won so many that I think apathy will kick in. But so let's just say, for example, the Warriors won this year and next year. You know, it wouldn't be hard for me to see where, like, you know, people start having a little bit of grousing over, like, who gets the credit or who does this or who does that. Like, you know, when this kind of stuff just seems to kind of happen with groups. Like, it's hard to have sustained success and have people, like, continually, you know, have the same drive that got them there. And you could maybe see them fall down. So I don't necessarily see it as a super dynasty that can't be stopped. I think that's just so rare to have something like that and so difficult to see that again that, you know, I think their run will be a little shorter than people maybe think it is. You know, I'd probably give them, you know, 2 to 3 more titles, you know, and that's it, probably not more than that, which would still make them one of the great dynasties in NBA. But I don't think it'll be one of those things of like, well, just turn off the league for the next 5 years. You got no chance.
Yeah. I mean, 2 to 3 titles in this environment, in this salary, in the way the NBA is today, is a incredible accomplishment. Additional to what they already have, which is 2.
Yeah, for sure. It is one of those things where if you win one title, your odds of winning another title are almost always much, much higher. Yeah. So if you look at like the last 30 years, pretty much, I think it's like half the teams have won more than one title, have won a title. You know, so it is like if you're good enough to win one, you usually can sustain that for a little bit. But in this era, it's hard to sustain that for, you know, like a decade. There'll never be a team like the Celtics again.
Right.
Back in the Bill Russell days. There'll never be a team like that. You could never keep a group together for that long. You know, the talent is too dispersed. There's too many teams in the past. Like, you'll never see a team, like, own the league for a decade. That just isn't going to happen again. But
yeah,
you can see teams that come together for, like, and this might also be really kind of just a rare set of circumstances that allowed them to put this team together of, like, guys' contracts all coming due at the right point and, you know, everything. Like, it's really hard for all the dominoes to line up in such a way that gives a team to have, you know, the opportunity to be what the Warriors are. So even this team, you might not see another team after this team fades out that becomes, you know, like, if say they win a total of 5 titles, it might be a while before we see another 5 title team. It would be very difficult to create in this era.
Doug, you've been more than generous with your time, so I'm going to ask one final question as we go into the new year. First of all, again, Happy New Year to you and your family. I'm so excited to have your voice back out in the Bulls stratosphere because it's an important voice to have, a calming and analytical influence that is sorely lacking for the last few years. I know you usually do most of your work on prepping for these, you know, great players potentially in this 2018 draft as we get closer to the draft, but you do hang around. I know you do hang around with a lot of the types that are familiar with who are the best players. Out of the guys and the names that you've heard, is there one that right now today you would like to see the Bulls pick if they had a number one pick? Or do you feel like you just need a little more time on that before you decide, hey, this is the guy to be a great fit with the Bulls?
I would say one I have not looked at who's in the draft. I mean, I know the names because everyone's got the taglines, you know, but I can't say I've watched these guys enough to really have any informed opinion. But I'd also say we haven't seen these guys enough to know yet either, right? So it's still very early in the college basketball season. You've not gotten to see these guys play enough in college yet to really even know, you know, how good you think some of these guys are going to be. You know, from my understanding, the top 4 guys are all potential, you know, franchise type changers, which means probably one of them really will be, and, you know, 2 of them will be very good but not really franchise changing, and 1 will be a bust. You know, something like that will be what actually ends up happening. But there are 4 guys people kind of tagged with that, you know, superstar potential. So if you could get one of those guys, and I would just trust that Paxson will pick the right guy, or Foreman, whoever. You know, the Bulls scouting department does a great job, as we discussed, at tremendous length. So what I do feel confident with is that if the Bulls get a good pick, that they will pick the right guys.
And one more guy I did want to mention is Trae Young, who's a point guard. And this is for a little bit different reason. You know, there's a lot of comparisons to him with Curry, you know, this kid, and he's not an elite. I think he's a good athlete. He's not an elite athlete by any stretch of the imagination, and he doesn't have a lot of those measurables physically that you'd like, but the kid can shoot, and he's a flat-out fantastic player, and he can pass the ball. He's a great point guard. The question I'd have is, you see like a player like that at the point guard position, do you feel Dunn can make the transition potentially to the shooting guard position? Do you think that could work? Bringing in another elite, fantastic point guard, could that work in the Bulls' backcourt?
I don't think, you know, and I've not watched Trae Young and know very little about him, But I would be thinking that one, Dunn could probably guard a shooting guard without a problem.
No doubt.
I think that would be fine. I do think, though, that Dunn's strengths right now are with the ball in his hands. He's not an off-the-ball player, in my opinion. So I think you'd really be mitigating what he could do. Now, maybe Trae Young could come in and you could not have him run the offense so much, and you could take advantage of his shooting. And I do think you always want multiple threats of people who can get to the basket. But I think Chris Dunn probably needs to be the guy who primarily has the ball in his hands to be a good fit on an NBA team. And if he's not going to be that guy for you, I think it's time to move on from Chris Dunn.
Yeah, I interesting comments. I feel Trae Young, the more I watch him, I think he could fit with Dunn in the fact that he could stretch the floor, be that shooter, and Dunn could be the penetrator, and maybe actually have Trae Young actually be the two-guard, right? Even though he doesn't have that physical two-guard body, on the offensive end, play the two-guard position, and on the defensive end, just assign, you know, Dunn to whoever the better backcourt player is and just tear that guy up.
I mean, I think you want Dunn getting the ball and just driving up the court like a runaway freight train. Like, that's really what Dunn brings you, is like the pressure and the speed. You know, that's what his strength is. Now, you still want multiple guys who can penetrate from the perimeter once you get in your half-court offense and you swing the ball around. I think you just want Chris Dunn being the guy who's taking the initial pass and bringing the ball up the floor as fast as possible. It doesn't mean he can't play with someone else who has point guard-like skills. In an ideal world, you want all five of your guys on the court to be able to drive, have great passing ability and great ball-handling ability, right? You would like everyone to be good at everything. It doesn't really ever work out that way, but, you know, you would love everyone to have all the tools. So I just think Dunn, because he's not a shooter, it's hard for me to see where he fits off the ball.
Doug, this has been fantastic. We're already at an hour. Thank you so much for your time. The Great One is back, and I couldn't be happier. And I think I speak for the vast majority of people who follow Bulls podcast. We're ecstatic to hear you again. So
yes, literally tens of people.
There's at least 25. I'd be willing to bet. But honestly,
thank you, Fred.
Happy New Year to you and your family. You're the best, my man. You're the best. Love you, brother.
Happy New Year to you and all the Bulls fans out there.
Take it easy, Doug. Have a good one.
All